Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barlingham Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my very good friend, veteran trial attorney, Manny Barling. Manny, hello.
Hi, everybody. It's a beautiful day in California. The weather dropped about 48 degrees this week, and I guess we don't have global warming, do we?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you a different question. I was cruising the news sites this morning, and I noticed that Southern California is leading the lower 48 states in gas prices. Rumors of $5 a gallon. Any thoughts on that?
And this is something I'm going to talk about. I wanted to start with our guests in a moment. It's revenge against the liberals. And, you know, I always say that big oil does not run political ads. What it does is it increases the cost of your oil to make certain that you let your politicians know what their position is. And I find that to be an interesting approach, but that's what they do. And we see that a lot here in California. And we also joke sometimes it's vindictive because we were always anti-Enron and everybody. So let's introduce our guests. We have, of course, distinguished Andrew Ian Dodge, who's running for the Senate in Maine and doing very, very well. And he's carrying the libertarian message and mm-hmm. championing it in a very unusual style. And we've had him as a guest before. He's always entertaining. And, you know, Andrew, we brought you some added support. You probably had a moment to talk to Sam Moffey, who's our eclectic libertarian from Ohio. And what's an eclectic libertarian? Well, you can figure that
every libertarian. Eclectic libertarians. I think that's every single one. Any libertarian that says he's not eclectic, you generally don't find out isn't a libertarian.
Well, you know, I have a view in life. I never have lunch with anyone who isn't eclectic because it's really very boring. So that's why you guys are so entertaining to us. And Sam, I know you're looking back there kind of chuckling at all this. And Sam's views are always entertaining to me. We scuffle all week with our emails and just had the best time. And again, Sam, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Manny. I haven't had a chance to talk to Andrew, but I have checked him out online, and I think it's great what you're doing.
Sure.
Keep up the good work. Maybe not this time, but it's always the next time.
Well, I'm doing my best to raise hell. And
Sam's already kissing ass this morning, okay?
Yeah, that's not bad. You know, I'm just raising some cane and raising issues at the same time, and to a certain extent entertaining people. And I don't. Someone has their phone on. That's a note. Oh no. But what's particularly interesting is, I don't know if you've been following what the Maine GOP has done this week, but they've managed to piss off World of Warcraft players. And it, I mean, at the peak, 17 million people played World of Warcraft, and they've decided that instead of going after someone for their political views, which is what you do in politics, they decided that it would be much better to trash the fact that she plays World of Warcraft and basically saying that all World of Warcraft players are fat slackers who don't do anything useful.
I think Big Bird feels safer now.
Yeah, I mean, my God, this thing got picked up by the BBC News, and Simon can tell you that the BBC News is looking for any story to get out from under the saga of Jimmy Savile right now. And they reported on it. They've reported on it in the UK and, you know, in other parts of the world. And it's sort of like the story has turned into it's about World of Warcraft instead of about this far-left person running for state senate. But that's the whole meme that's going along. And it used to be you'd have the parties doing these stupid things and the establishment would just ignore it. And what I'm trying to do and what I've been doing a lot in my election is I just poke fun at it. I mean, I have a message, but I poke fun at it because I'm fortunate enough because I'm married to Kim and my sense of fun as well. We have a whole different amount of approaches to a problem and getting a message out some resonate with others, some doesn't, some don't, and it makes it easier, and it also makes it less boring for us. Putting out a boring press release once every couple of days, going, my opponent is blah blah blah, gets dull. It's much more fun to be satirical and everything else, and it entertains people like you. And this Maine Senate race is the nuttiest one ever. I don't know how much you follow. We have the Republicans buying adverts for the Democrat Cynthia Dill, who so far her poll ratings have doubled. Angus King is getting money despite being an independent from Democratic fundraisers, and Charlie Summers hasn't been endorsed by Romney at all, and he's running away from all the debates. I think that's it so far. It's
wow.
Just mad. It's nuts. And that's why it's so much fun, and we're getting attention from all over the place because this is completely abnormal. First of all, there's six people in the race, all right? That's abnormal.
Yeah, it is.
That's great.
You have four viable candidates. You have me, I've never run for anything, but I have political experience all over the world. I've debated at the English-speaking Union. You know, I know what I'm doing. And they don't know what to do with me. And then you have, you know, they're panicking and saying, well, you know, you're only helping Angus King win, so you could drop out. Well, in other words, basically you're saying that I have 8% or 9% in polls that you're not releasing, because how else would I be threatening Summers? You know, it's
absolutely.
Okay, Sam, it's time for you to talk to Andrew. I mean, any comments?
Well, I haven't ever had a chance to talk to him. I've just been enjoying listening to him. I think it's great that there's that he's doing so well in a Senate race. I mean, think of that. Terrific that a Libertarian can run so strong, do well with what he has. But Maine is a perfect state for a guy like you to get elected some point as a Libertarian. Or New Hampshire or whatnot. I live in Ohio. The Libertarian parties around here are, I hate to say it because they're just not taken seriously because they can't get serious candidates. Or the Greens or all this. I'm all for as many political parties as any, the more the merrier. You know, the more ideas we have out there, the better. And if people come to you and they say, well, you know, you got to drop out of the race. You're helping candidate A or B, as you just said. You must be doing something right. You know, and keep up the good work. Do that because Maine's the type of state that could elect a Libertarian.
Well,
I hope you're the guy.
Very much so.
Simon, I told you this was going to be a love fest. Listen, I'm in the back going.
Well, man, you and I haven't started blasting each other. As long as we're talking movies, you and I were in a love fest, right?
But the interesting thing, guys, the interesting thing is that a Midwest Libertarian and a Coastal Libertarian, I've been to the Libertarian National Conference.
My view is there's a sign when you enter Ohio that says, please leave your brain at the state line. So, you know, I can understand Sam's distress. To add to the joke, Andrew, my wife is from Youngstown, Ohio, which is where Sam lives. So we have a running thread because having visited my in-laws for too many years to admit, I don't hold Ohio and the politics there in the highest regard. And part of it is exactly what Sam you know, talks about. I think those people aren't willing to listen to new concepts. And I also think, because I want to pass it back to you, because here's a subject I want both of you to address. One of the problems with libertarians, I think, right now is Ron Paul. It is both his strength and his weakness. It's foreign policy. And he leaves the feeling that the foreign policy of, you know, basically libertarians is a pacifist one and against any type of war movement. And I think that that has had a negative influence. And until the libertarians can field a candidate who does not share those viewpoints, I think it will be difficult for them.
Well, first of all, obviously Ron Paul isn't a libertarian. He's a Republican. And the interesting thing about this is that Ron Paul actually is not a libertarian. He's a paleoconservative. He just happens to be a states' rights paleoconservative. He believes that all these things matters of import that should be done at the state level. He's as pro-life as you know, as Aiken, he's he believes life begins at contraception. He's not very keen on gay rights and everything else, and people don't realize that. The real libertarian presidential candidate is actually Gary Johnson. Now, Gary Johnson annoys some purist libertarians because, in fact, he is a defense libertarian. Now, a defense libertarian is one who believes we should definitely have a military who is capable of defending us, but that our military shouldn't be running off around the world nation-building or peacekeeping. It should be for our defensive purposes only and there to react to attacks like going to Afghanistan, not hanging around in Afghanistan for God knows how many years and trying to do what the Russians, the British, the Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great, all tried to tame that part of the world, and it failed. And for the Americans to think that they can actually turn that into a caring and sharing democracy is just idiotic and anti-historical. I think that's where the line is drawn between the ability to defend yourself and the ability to and projecting power or, you know, being world's policeman.
Well, you know, I happen to agree with you on that, and Sam and I do too. And in that regard, I share. And by the way, I share so many views with libertarians, but usually that is where I cross the line. Is I just don't agree with their foreign policies. But yeah, I think it's really important to take a look at the fact that this country has to deal with the concept that nation building is a dream of the Republicans for reasons that have more to do with the economy, which is to create a war-based economy and feed their allies within the defense industry. And as I say to Sam all the time, because I'd like you and Sam to address this, if we're going to nation build, we have nation build in Mexico, take over that country, because if you want to stop immigration problems, you could stop it at the core of what's wrong in Mexico, because basically those people are oppressed by a government that's been taking advantage of them for years, or in cohorts with the drug company, the drug lords, et cetera. And if we cured the root of the problems in Mexico, they wouldn't want to immigrate to the U.S.
Well,
anybody have any feelings about that?
I just want to say that I wasn't really good at physics in school, but I do know that heat and sand makes glass. So you could just atom bomb the entire Middle East and fix it.
That's a popular military expression, you know, turning another country into glass.
No.
Very much so. Well,
yeah.
I mean, I also would. I don't think it's only the Republicans. I hear quite a few Democrats who are, you know, in some senses they're not necessarily against what we're doing in certain parts of the world, but they want more caring and sharing and nation building, like in Somalia and Sudan, and we have troops in Yemen and all those other places. They don't, you know, they're not pro war, but they want to send peacekeeping forces who get shot at and have to defend themselves with guns and peacekeep. Somalia is another place. It's not a country. The U.S. has no business trying to turn that into a democracy. It's a ridiculous notion. So Democrats, or at least Democrats in D.C., are just as responsible as Republicans. And you could say, you know, you could say their reasoning is slightly different, but the end result is you still have American forces in places they shouldn't be, doing things they weren't meant to be, and getting killed for it. And you know, that's where I think we come together. But I do have a problem with and constantly discuss this with libertarians that think if you came home and the country stuck its head in the sand, no one would ever attack us again. I mean, that's just ahistorical and counter historical. But we are. You know, attempting to do things which don't really work and will never work. I mean, trying to tame Afghanistan. Hello, how nuts is that?
Yeah, I agree with you. It was nuts for the Russians, and it's nuts for us still.
Yeah, didn't we try it in Vietnam?
Well, that's a different situation. Okay. It wasn't that we were nation building in Vietnam. If you study the history of Vietnam, you know, basically. What's his name? Ho Chi Minh was supported the United States, and actually when he took over in the revolution, worked in Vietnam, and the World War II came in, he actually played the American National Anthem and wanted to create a state like the United States. And what happened was France, in order to cooperate, the U.S. in order to get cooperation from the French in terms of dealing with Eastern Europe, particularly Berlin and other issues, sold out the Vietnamese and put it back under French rule in exchange for the help that they wanted at that particular time. And that sellout alienated them, as you would expect it would, using someone else's country as a bargaining chip at the table. And that's what started that decline.
But
buddy French.
The big deal here is it's obvious to everyone that we have huge issues to deal with on our own shores. Why are we spending all this money fighting someone else's battles?
Well, let me give you a jump in and then grab it, guys. It's about money. It's about if right now we cut off some of these wars, we will go into a deeper recession because a huge amount of this so-called money that's going to support these nations actually goes to defense contractors. They are the beneficiaries of this. And never forget that that money is paid to GM, Ford, and a lot of people who are politically strong enough to help lobby all of these various laws into effect. Don't you agree, gentlemen?
I agree with you in part, and I mean that's what the frustration thing is. And you get this argument from people about our aid to Israel. Well, I happen to know several Israelis, and one who is pretty knowledgeable, and he said what people don't understand is it's not a direct money is not given to the Israelis for the most part.
Right.
I should finish my thought. It's like mandates to the states. You know when the DC says, we got this great new program you're going to have to do. Here's a mandate. And then it's unfunded. What happens in this case is you have money that goes to the Israelis, but they have to give it back, or they don't even give it back, to defense contractors. In fact, the Israeli military sometimes gets weapons they don't want because they make a superior product at home, but some American politician has stuck it into a treaty or an agreement with Israel that they have to buy a certain amount of X or Y, Z from the company in their constituency. It's another form of kickback for politicians who want to keep jobs.
And Israel's the only country, my understanding, and thank you for bringing it up, that is in that sort of a quid pro quo.
No, that's not true at all.
The rest of the country just get their aid and do whatever the heck they want to do with it?
No, that's one of the bitches about Pakistan has with us, with our aid to Pakistan that everybody makes a big deal about. I want to cut foreign aid, but I'm mindful that to cut foreign aid in certain areas is to effectively cut the legs out from under certain American manufacturers, which is why you have trouble. Every time that you go to cut foreign aid, not only do you get the foreign countries lobbying, you get the major corporations lobbying.
Well, but you can't even get, I mean, I understand that, and I think you misunderstood what I was saying, but that's, if you saw Rand Paul after the 9/11 attack in Libya, he and some other senators tried to lobby to get aid immediately stopped from to Libya, Egypt, you know, and all the countries where fires were raging. And
they're trying to kill us. Yes, that concept of we're giving money to countries that try to kill us. Yeah.
Right, and that was it. And he couldn't even get – I'm trying to prove your point, Manny, is that – or help you with it – is that he only could get 90 of the other senators didn't even want to hear it because they're probably being lobbied by everybody.
That's my point.
Right.
Yeah,
you know?
So we're all agreeing, just saying it a different way.
Yeah.
It's retired. I mean, there is a certain type of person who says, no, we can't have any foreign aid to anyone. Yeah, okay, you can argue that. I would say a better way of putting it is until we tackle our $16 trillion debt, we shouldn't be spending giving money we're borrowing from the Chinese to anyone. Fine.
Correct.
That's the point. But it's really retarded. I don't know if either of you saw my Politiker video. I said it's like the mob. Okay, the mob used to be protection racket. They come to you as a business and they say, unless you pay us, your place won't get trashed and won't get burnt and you won't get beat up. So people pay them. It's called, you know, protection money. We're paying protection money to Middle East countries, and then they turn around and still kill us. How stupid are we?
Okay, Andrew, I have to ask you about Japan, the tsunami. You know, in today's wired world, that there were all sorts of videos of the event, the destruction. Let's face it, Japan is all growed up, all right? They have an economy that relatively booms. And so why the hell were we sending money to Japan?
I think that's partly because politicians always like to look caring and sharing, and I suspect politicians with a large Japanese contingency in their constituency said, "Oh, we got to send aid." And what's really funny, I know quite a few people who work for aid agencies. Half the time, governments are sending aid that they don't want. They're saying, "No, look, just we need this," and they send them all kinds of extraneous crap that they can't use.
Yeah.
And also, there's a fundamental difference between, okay, that there's a major natural disaster and the U.S. and Israel and other countries send aid workers and, you know, emergency supplies and all the rest of the stuff, and, they get it there quickly. That's different to this sort of money that we're sending to Pakistan, which is going to the ISI, which they're giving to the Taliban, which they're giving to Al-Qaeda to blow us up. There's a huge difference in that. There's a huge difference.
So,
and also,
you know,
the problem with most of this aid, especially to the third world, and anybody who's spent any time in the third world, and if you've talked to people who work in the third world, is not very much of it actually goes to the people who need it. It's far more efficient to give it not to a government agency, to give it to one of these charities, because the charities have a much better luck at getting into people who really need it and not wasting. You look at a lot of the major charities, and the amount of money they spend on administration is like 15%, 10%. You look at when it's done by government, the bureaucracy is like half of it.
Sort of like our own domestic policies.
Well, wait a minute. Andrew, I can't let you go with that one. I have an older brother who specializes in that arena and clears charities for major corporations before they make donations to make certain that they're not embarrassed by the donations. Well, you'd be surprised at how many of them he catches fudging it and doing things that are basically illegal. And one of the worst ones to me and the biggest fraud is the Red Cross. They're the most deceitful group I've ever watched in my life. We had an incident in California where we had a huge fire in San Diego a couple of years ago, if you remember it, that wiped out even homes of famous football players and all that. Well, we raised over $1 billion in California to that, and basically they sat on the money and started using it for other things. And when they got caught, their response is, oh, we have to keep this in reserve in case we have problems somewhere else. And everybody in this state went ballistic and turned on the Red Cross. And that's what they do.
That is ridiculous. Well, there was a funny case of a charity in the UK. Well, it's not very funny. Called Christian Aid, and it turns out they were actually sending money to terrorist organizations, because someone cleverly set up this Christian Muslim Federation, whatever, something like that. And so Christian Aid was giving their money instead of following it all the way down to the people got it, and it was being funneled to I can't remember who it was.
But you know, I always find humor in it because, as Simon will tell you, the Brits do not take kindly to this. I mean, they were ready to roast somebody.
Oh, well, trust me, the whole scandal right now about Jimmy Savile is just, I mean,
I
every
know.
Day. I actually think this may, in fact, not that a U.S. senator has anything to say about this, I think this may, in fact, be the death knell to the license fee. I really do. I think the Jimmy Savile thing, with all the people not ignoring it, And it, the you know, BBC in the 70s was a haven for pedophiles, as far as they can tell.
Oh, well, it was.
That's going to kill the license fee. The politicians who want to get rid of it are going to finally say, look, you cannot expect people to pay 130 quid, whatever it is. And this is what their money went to in the 70s and the 60s and 70s and 80s. You can't justify it anymore. I think the BBC will fundamentally change from top to bottom because of this scandal.
Okay. And that brings up the infamous question. Last week we had the presidential debate, and Romney wants to roast Big Bird.
He doesn't want to roast Big Bird. He doesn't think the federal government, that $16 trillion in debt, I'm a libertarian, I support Gary Johnson, that $16 trillion in debt should be giving money to PBS, who makes shedloads of money on merchandising all this stuff and could probably pay for themselves.
No, they can't pay for themselves. And where I disagree with that is it started with Ronald Reagan axing Operation Head Start. The bottom line is PBS is primarily directed towards younger children and at preschool ages, and what they do is extraordinary and should not be discounted. And I also disagree with him to the extent that the way he voiced it, and I'm talking about politically now, I think as a candidate you would have never taken the approach he did, and he got just fiery and over the top and used it to illustrate a point, and he lost his point. And that happens quite frequently, as we both
I didn't actually watch the debate because we libertarians are boycotting it because they don't have Gary Johnson in it. However, I was following it online. I didn't watch it on television. So obviously Romney won, but oh my God. Talk about waffle and blither.
Well, and lying.
And lying. Well, that.
No, the other guy did that too, but he just didn't do it as well as Romney did.
It's just,
well,
oh
that's true. You and I agree.
Sam, yeah. You say that again.
Well, they were both Manny and Andrew were saying he lied, he did this, he did that, and Obama did the same thing. He just didn't do it as well. According to Al Gore, the temperature was too, the altitude, that was hilarious. But in serious, I really think that, it goes back to what my wife said when we were watching the debate. And when what kind of guy schedules a debate on his anniversary, on his wedding anniversary? That was the first thing she
said. I said the same thing, too. What a the kiss of death.
Why did he agree to this date? Does he forget what his wife? I don't believe he forgot. I just think he's, that was bad, okay, on the side. Some women might see it that way or whatnot, but he just didn't look like, he looked like a guy who didn't want to be there. I don't think it's because he thinks he's this, some of the people in the media, both left and right, say he's the greatest, he's this, he graduated from Harvard, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff. Last Wednesday night, he was the worst I've ever seen him since he bounced onto the national scene.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, I
agree. And I find it odd that the guy's been president for 4 years. I mean, he looked like somebody who just, what have you been doing for the last three and three quarter years in your office if you can't get up there with all this, with your degrees and your knowledge and your advisors and your this, that, and every day, and it's probably 24/7 for a presidential candidate or a senatorial candidate. I mean, that's all you're doing is eating, breathing, and running a campaign. Is not correct?
Well, and actually, you bring up an interesting point. There's a guy running in Maine, Angus King. He's a friend of the family. My mother worked for him. I know him. Nice guy. Politically, don't agree with him. He's got a staff like you would not believe. And the problem is, during a debate, he's a clever guy, but instead of going writing things down, he was looking to his staff, and they were holding up signs to him. So it came across as a bit stilted. And it's really appalling to me that these are people running for high office, never mind the fact that Summers is running away from all of them, and they can't debate. They don't have the art of rhetoric. And it's appalling to me. And it's just that debate, the presidential debate, is just an example of that. by the way, unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to watch the rumble between Ryan and Biden. I hope I can find that somewhere online, because that is going to be brutal. I mean, Ryan is a bright fellow. Biden is not, and he certainly can't debate. That's going to be brutal. I mean, I think Ryan has to be very careful not to be too harsh on Biden, or people are going to feel sorry for Biden because you're beating up on an old man.
Well,
I've gotten in trouble for doing that. When you're younger and you debate competitively, or you're doing debates, you know, if you start really hammering someone, and you know they're falling apart, and you keep it up, I've actually lost a judge out of three. I still won the debate because they said I was being overly nasty and I was over the top. And you can get that because people, even though Americans are not like the British who have the underdog, there's a percentage of Americans who have that underdog vibe and they don't like seeing someone pummeled. It's a buggery. And I think he really has to worry. He really, really has to be careful of that because, you know, Biden says dumb things.
You know, actually, I thought that's how George Bush got elected, frankly. I had a friend of mine say, and I said, what's with you and Bush? He goes, he sounds like us. You know, he's inarticulate, stumbles, and I want a president who sounds like us. I looked at him kind of like, huh? I mean, that's a hell of a way to decide who you choose in the election.
Well, don't you think there's lots of people who make those, whether he sounds like or there's the one, he's good on the looks. There's people who vote just on looks. People
Clinton?
Just vote on
How
party ID.
How do you think Clinton
ID?
Got elected the first time?
Yep.
All these women said he's good looking and he's charismatic.
You guys didn't have an opportunity to see Jack Kennedy at work. I mean, women almost fell on the ground when he walked in.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, it's not everybody is as anal retentive as we are about politics, and that's something that my wife continuously reminds me, and she says that's why every opportunity you get to speak to anybody, or, you know, I've got two television interviews this week, and then I'm in all the televised debates, that you have to be very careful, because there are a lot of people that will see you once or twice, and they won't go to your website, they won't read about everything you have to say. You say, and they make judgments because they have a life. Your life consists of whatever, and you're interested in politics. But, you know, most of the human race isn't as obsessed with politics as you are.
You know,
you have to remind yourself of all the time.
You know, Andrew, this is why I see so many successful lawyers do well in politics, because you constantly deal with a concept in a trial scenario.
Mm.
You're looking at people who don't care, aren't really well-informed, don't really want to be well-informed, and suddenly you ask him to pass a judgment in what may be a technically difficult case, as and may have 10,000 paper exhibits and other things that would tax their normal consumption. And, yeah, it is a problem, and being able to measure what you can say to people and what's effective to people oftentimes is more important than being a good speaker.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first, I love this. I hadn't been in the U.S. back from the U.S. with Kim for that long, and I did that 8,000-mile, 26-day trip across the country. First couple times I spoke, people clapped. They nominally realized that they agreed with me, but I was talking over their heads, and they'd all clap. And Kim just said, "You were talking over their heads. You can't talk like you're at Oxford Union. You just can't do a speech like that. You need." Talking to the common man. Nothing against them and nothing against you, but you're not talking to a bunch of politically aware swats who actually follow elections all over the world. And it's something that you constantly have to remind yourself about.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. It's a fascinating process to realize how you connect with people. And you know, it's amazing. But one of the easiest ways of doing it, I have to tell you, in Maine, is just be yourself.
I will offer you this side. I've had this conversation with Simon for a great many times. My father was British, and he came to the United States, an Oxford graduate, and he never could adapt to what I call the common man. It was always his weakness, and his relationships there, and it stymied his ability to do a great many things in our country because he could not communicate successfully with the, just an average truck driver, so to speak. My mother used to go crazy. She ran a number of restaurants, and she would keep my father away from everybody because, you know, by the time it was done, all the employees would be up in arms, you know, and because his style worked well in Britain but didn't work well in the United States, and that's a problem.
Yeah, and the good thing about New England, and especially northern New England, is it's kind of like a halfway house. Well, we're sort of like a halfway house between us and Canada. And of course, you have Maine and the Nova Scotia and PEI, and those parts of Canada separated from the rest of Canada by Quebec. They're more British, really. They really are. There are a lot of attitudes, including going back to the original argument, the original thing of the underdog. There's that sense of sort of that I really don't even know how to put a finger on it, that you don't get in the Midwest, that you don't get in the South. And that's why you have people in we have a Green Party in Maine. We have a Green Party on the ballot in Maine. In a lot of places in this country, I have people going, you can't complain about anything. You're involved. You're on every one of the TV debates. That doesn't happen. We only have two people on the TV debates. If that, you know, in our state, it's unprecedented to have anybody but the main parties. And I have to keep being reminded of that, and I remind the rest of my independent candidate friends that we are very lucky to be in a state which says, hey, if you got your ass on the ballot, you deserve to be on it in these debates. You deserve to be on.
Okay, I have to ask you this. You mentioned spending a great deal of time, you know, romping around the U.S., and I think that was under the Tea Party flag.
Yep, it was.
All right. How come you are running as a libertarian as opposed to a Tea Party Republican?
Well, I was Newsweek, I think it was, or Time. I think it was Newsweek, declared me as leader of the Tea Party, of the libertarian insurgency in the Tea Party movement. The Tea Party movement is first of all, it's not a party, and secondly, it's this conglomeration of various different groupings of people. Now, if you want to talk about parties, there are Republicans in the Tea Party movement. There are Constitution Party people in the movement, in the Tea Party movement. There are libertarians. There are people who are never been in part of a party. There are independents, and there may even there were, in some places there were even Greens, because not all Greens are hard left. It's very confusing. So, it's kind of my attitudes have never changed, and my opinions have never changed. But the Tea Party movement was actually very welcoming to those because, more or less, on fiscal issues, the Tea Party movement and I and many libertarians agreed. And the Tea Party movement was never about social issues in the first place, and it still isn't. And Tea Party groupings that try to go social lose a lot of members immediately because there are plenty of organizations that already exist to serve social moray needs. And the Tea Party movement, the beauty of it, is that it's obsessed with fiscal issues.
I think you bring up a great point, though. The Tea Party around here is not that good at all. There really isn't one. But those that do get together are exactly what you just said. And they have shunned social issues. They're sick of that stuff. And they want. And the Tea Party, to them, sort of was a melting pot of many different people, some Democrats, some Republicans from around there, a lot of Libertarians, Green Party, just dissatisfied people with the status quo, and they saw the Tea Party as their ladder to climb up to change things in Washington. And if the Democratic Party would have embraced the enthusiasm, they would have went to the Democratic Party candidates and helped them, but they didn't. with the Republican Party, they were able to infiltrate at the grassroots level and be successful in 2010. Will they be in helping, you know, Congress, the House of Representatives go to the Republican Party? Now, will they show up again, or they split, or this, that? That's going to be, we'll know that on November 7th. But I like the
I
way
think
you,
it depends on where we are. I think it depends on where you are, because in some places, Maine, the Tea Party movement, more or less, has been destroyed by Republican Party operatives who've come in and basically driven out anybody who isn't a Republican or isn't an establishment Republican. They've done a very good job.
That's happened here in Ohio.
I have friends in the Ohio Tea Party movement, that's happened. It's happened everywhere. Because
I think they're afraid of what, and I think, you know, this goes back to what Manny was talking about, and it was interesting to hear your take on Ron Paul, by the way. When Manny was talking about Ron Paul, the Paulites did an excellent job in Maine, in Nevada, there's certain states they took over the whole local, the state Republican Party. I know, and...
Well, they didn't take... Okay, I can speak to that. They thought they took over the Republican Party. They're learning that they haven't. Because,
oh, I don't mean the national party, like state.
No, no, I mean
state.
The local party. They thought they took it over. They haven't. In fact, right now the Maine Republican Party is doing everything they can to cull the Ron Paul supporters and libertarians. In fact, the chairman of the Maine Republican Party, I kid you not, and I will send a link to anybody who doesn't believe me, said the Maine Republican Party doesn't need libertarians and Ron Paul supporters. They're not real Republicans. They should join something else.
I'm not surprised by that.
No,
and gentlemen, I disagree with what I was saying. I watch it closely. I have a lot of friends of mine who wanted to get in the party, and all of them were turned off by the effect of Republican Party. And I don't agree with you, Sam. The views expressed by the Tea Party people I've watched, listened to, et cetera, except for people like Andrew, are essentially policies of what I would call the right wing, more extreme.
I have not talked to a lot of right. The Tea Party people I know, they echo what Andrew's talking about. I'm sure the ones out there that have are as far right as and whatnot. It was a broad based movement, and now that it was successful, and people are trying to co-op it for their own.
No. You're missing my point because you're so busy defending him. My point is that the basic Tea Party members' viewpoints would never mesh with the Democratic Party. And that's one reason. It wasn't that, gee, if the Democrats embraced some ABC would have happened. They were never going to embrace them because their viewpoints are so far apart and that they were only really suitable within the framework of the Republican Party, whether or not that in the long run is successful or not successful remains to be seen. But it could never function within that.
I think the Tea Party movement, but I agree with you that, but then again, there's certain parts of the country where the Democrats are farther right than the Republicans. So I think in California, certainly, I have a very good friend who's heavily involved with the Tea Party Patriots and no longer is. He's from Orange County, he's Jewish, and he encountered everything. I mean, he and I both encountered everything from the people who are, you know, if they'd been in Franco's Germany, they would have been Francoists. Yeah, I mean, we're talking fascists. I'm not talking them Nazis. I'm talking fascists, authoritarians. Okay. You know, we should be a Christian country, and if you're not Christian, you shouldn't be allowed to run for office. We should ban this and ban that and ban this and ban that. And then we encountered everybody from those to people who were, you know, sort of hippies who woke up and there was everything. And the problem became, and the reason the Tea Party movement, I think, is not as strong as it could be, is that there were a whole bunch of groups, including the John Birch Society, the American Family Association, and various other ones that attempted to co-opt the Tea Party movement, and if they got a group, they would drive out anybody who didn't agree with them. Instead of understanding the broad tent concept of having all these people, you know, leave your, yeah, all right, fine, you're anti-abortion, but we're talking about fiscal issues here. We're talking about debt, deficit, spending, all the rest of those things. instead of doing
that. And Andrew, I agree with you, and that's the point that gets lost when I say that, is there is a constant hijacking of smaller groups, trying to make them conform to the agenda of the larger group, which is an interest they share in controlling the electoral outcome, and the only way they can do it is to avoid having people with different viewpoints. So what starts out to be a strength in the eyes of the party, in this case the Republican Party, becomes a problem. That happened with ultra-liberals during the time when the Democratic Party was moving towards a more liberal base, as the other Democrats tried to seize that liberal base because it was in their best interest too. That's part of American politics, and it's also not a very good part of American politics.
Well, look at Occupy. The Occupy movement had suffered and is suffering from the same problem. You had all these groups trying to drag it back and forth, and Occupy in some places was more, not libertarian, but more, you know, sort of the sort of agorist, volunteerist libertarians. And in other places, they were communist hard left. And so it didn't really work that there wasn't sort of, there wasn't this continuity, and that's why it fell apart.
I agree.
Okay. All right. Andrew, a question on the Occupy movement. Was there a point, or was it just, you know, bunch of people going, I'm grumpy, I don't know what I'm grumpy about?
I think the Occupy movement, much like, I don't think it had a focus as much as the Tea Party movement, really. The Tea Party movement to start out with was about fiscal issues solely. And I think the Occupy movement, there were all these things that pissed them off. And there were some that sort of were, it was, you know, almost Tea Party. It was like against bailouts. Yeah, we disagreed with that. Against all those things. And then there were others who just hated it, rich people, were anti-capitalist and everything else. I think it was a coming together of people, some of whom thought that they could work with for a similar agenda, which was against the Wall Street bailout. I mean, you had Occupy people who agreed with the bailout of GM and the bailout of various other things. They just hated the Wall Street bailout. And then you had Occupy people who didn't like any of the bailouts. And the Occupy people in Brunswick Bay, and a friend of mine was talking to them, and they're all voting Democratic.
Okay, I have to ask Sam a question here. I was watching CNN earlier this morning, and there was an interesting discussion about the automotive industry and how the bailout of the automakers saved your state, and now I think that the latest numbers are 7.2% unemployment. Would you have gone along with the bailout?
No, I'm totally against the bailouts from GM, all the banks, everything. I think that was a terrible thing, a terrible precedent that was set, especially the GM. I know a lot of GM workers. See, you have to remember, Delphi Automotive was part of GM at one point. And when they did the managed bankruptcy, I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, I don't even really understand it, but it my understanding of a lot, the Delphi retirees, and there were a lot of them, they were UAW workers, they paid into the system, they got screwed, they didn't get anything, but
the actual
UAW workers and retirees were saved. They were saved. Delphi was thrown under the bus. Small bondholders, and I know some of them around here, were thrown under the bus. They didn't get anything. There was a lot of small creditors who I live near this Lordstown plant that Manny knows very well. There's 3,500 workers there from all over America. They shut down plants all over America, Kansas City, Pittsburgh, New York, some in Tennessee, some in Michigan, and they kind of housed them at Lordstown while they were retooling with the crews. And now all those people, because I know a lot of them, they frequent up my bar, and I've heard the stories that they say about what their lives are going through, because they have a home. They have a home that they have to manage in Tennessee. They still have, they live in an apartment here. They're working ungodly amounts of hours, and you know, they want to go home, and they can't because they got to have this job here. I mean, just, and that's just the human tragedy of it. But the other parts are is that I think if it would have been bankrupt the way normal bankruptcies are supposed to happen, as I understand them, I still think GM would have come out okay, or all the parts would have been bought up by Ford or Toyota or something else. And
yeah, no, I agree with you 100%.
Okay, guys, I've let Sam slip on this because I haven't really.
One more thing. The stock price. The stock price was at $50 a share when under the Obama administration. It's now what, Manny? $25? $22? I think John knows.
That's not what I want to talk about. You talk about bankruptcy, okay? I've spent a lifetime in it. But I work within the arena where it's a very common aspect in my legal career. All bankruptcies are fixed, okay? No one files a bankruptcy unless they know exactly what the outcome is going to be. The purpose of bankruptcy is to shed creditors in an extraordinarily manipulative way. Individuals do it, corporations do it. And the minute you see a bankruptcy being filed, your first inclination is someone's getting out the knife and fork and they're carving somebody up. It's sad. It's horrible. I have fought it on every level in my career, and that's what happens. I saw an interesting interview with Nancy Pelosi, who's not one of my favorite people, and I was about to shut it off when she actually said something I was interested in, which is hard for her. And by the way, this is not a current dislike. I have followed her career in San Francisco from the first time that she ran, because she ran in a district where a number of my friends lived. And so I saw her. I met her very early in her career at local cocktail parties, despised her. I haven't changed my feelings. But she pointed out a story that I called a couple friends of mine in the stock business and confirmed. Bernanke went to Pelosi and a whole bunch of other people, not just Democrats, a mixed group, and it was somewhere around in August before the Bush election, 2008, and basically it said to him, if you don't take this action now, we're going to have another 1929 and this country is going to crash, and scared the bejesus out of everybody in Congress and freaked everybody out to a point where they decided they had to start taking some of these actions. So I want to bring that up because I know both Sam and I have strong feelings about the craziness that goes on with the Fed at the Fed and how deceptive it is and harmful it is to the average American. So weighing that for just a moment, that was part of the factor in it. But when you will see in every bankruptcy, all the low-end creditors get jettisoned because they don't have good enough lawyers and they're not able to fight in a manner to protect their rights. Oftentimes, because the rights are not carefully safeguarded within agreements, and unions never did enough to protect themselves within the framework of their contracts and expose themselves to this. Now, that is a problem that everybody has to face. So, yes, that's a major factor into it. I don't agree with you about it. My experience in business is that when companies like that go bankrupt, and I've dealt with a few of them, the chaos is unbelievable. And the feeling was that chaos would have driven this country into an even worse situation than the others did. I don't like it. I didn't agree with it because I thought there was a better way to solve the problem. But the minute they headed for bankruptcy, to me, it was just all over.
But the point with them is that, first of all, the bailout hasn't worked because it looks like they're bumming for more money. And then they went and did something stupid and wasted a lot of money on the self-immolating Chevy Volt, and amazingly, GM actually has a car called the Chevy Flame, I think it is. And you're just sort of saying, no, Chevy Spark. The cars are burning, and they release a car called the Chevy Spark.
Like the Pinto.
Yeah, like a Pinto. Well, yeah, I actually think we should ship all those cars to France, because the next time the youth start riding, they don't have to hurt themselves because the cars just burn themselves. Then you get export, raise our exports, and the French who like to burn cars will be happy.
Yeah, well, you know, that's a good line. Okay. I like that. But you know, what the situation with the GM is, you know, and they're running around, they're doing that, and you know, Manny, the United Auto Workers, and you all you gentlemen know this, that the UAW is a huge arm of the Democratic Party, just like the Republicans have, the people who run around, you know, the Christian right who rally for them and stand up at the polls
Sam,
and all that. But what
Sam,
I keep,
Sam, throw in the coal miners unions and all the unions.
Oh, yeah. Well, the coal miners are, you know, I don't know if you'd be sure. I should have taken some pictures. I was all the coal miners because, again, you know, I'm in the swing state. I'm on the PA, West Virginia, Ohio, New York border
right.
In that area. The signs the coal miners are putting up, it's just amazing to me. I never thought I'd ever see coal working unions putting signs up saying, Save America, Fire Obama, and Stop His War on Coal. Right or wrong, whatever it is, that's what they believe. You know, that is what they are out in by the truckloads doing that. And but, you know, like I said, there's, you know, I've seen some of the when GM went bankrupt. Now, I'll tell you what someone – I have this bar that is, I'm right in Spook Central, as they like to say. Where I've got people coming in from GM, and I got people coming in from some of the dealerships that were closed down, which was a bad thing too, and all of that who used to work at those dealerships and all that. And we were all there. You know, we were kind of like no man's land, the bar. It was very interesting, the arguments coming forth. But the thing that really killed a lot of people around here who weren't connected to GM – they owe the government and the taxpayers lots of money, and they all got $5,000 bonuses in a very tough economy. That really pissed off a lot of people. Now, you know, did they deserve it or what or not? I don't know. I don't run their books. I'm sure they're cooked very well. But when they all get those $5,000 bonuses right after the first of the year, most of everybody else around here wasn't for GM at that point. You know, they felt, and basically they felt like they'd been used, they're taxpaying money. And I know that the small scale, it's only $5,000 per person. But the one thing I've learned about General Motors is today General Motors only has more people working overseas than it does the United States of America.
That's
right. Well, yeah, because
that's mind-boggling to me.
They own Holden. They also own Opel. They own Vauxhall. They're an international company.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling to me.
Wait a minute, guys. Let's come back. Now I want to shift gears a moment. Wait a minute, guys. I want to shift.
Can I ask a question? This is actually a personal thing. Can I take a bio break, or is the show about to go in?
We'll just keep talking while you're gone.
Okay. Bio break.
Yeah. So anyway, make a long story short, Sam. One of the basic points of it's missing all of this, and now I've actually forgotten my point. He did such a good job of that. Has to do with what do you call it? The Romney. Romney talks about these 12 million jobs, and as I say to you, how are we going to have 12 million jobs when the reality is that they're making money by sending jobs overseas, and nothing has occurred to change that basic structure. So how's it going to add, go say, oh, I'm going to come in and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, when the reality is he can't do it. And he can't do it because they are finding success reducing their U.S. number of jobs and replacing it with people overseas. And that's the problem. And that's the problem with his ridiculous job claims of Romney, is he cannot produce those jobs without changing the way jobs are sent abroad, and he's not doing that. So if he generates more money in the income, it's just more profit to the corporations. And that's
I agree with you, Manny. I mean, I don't know how he's going to create 12 million jobs either. I don't know how he's going to create a million jobs.
I don't either.
Okay, but you know what? I don't think Obama's plan is going
to
create a million jobs either.
Unless
it's stimulus money for more government workers to be hired. And that's not right. That's not the way to go either.
My point. The point is we need to accept that we have a bigger problem that isn't solved by a bunch of rhetoric from a bunch of politicians.
That's what we're going to get into elected to the Senate.
There is a way to generate jobs, but I personally am a little scared about it. We can increase oil and gas exploration, but we've seen what happened with the Exxon Valdez. We've certainly seen what happened with Deep Sea Horizon. We need to wean ourselves off foreign oil, but
I agree with
how
that.
Do we do it safely?
Well, first of all, as I point out to you, we are foreign oil. I mean, the bulk of this foreign oil stuff comes from American and European-based companies that don't want to give this up, and that has been the issue since time immemorial. PBS years ago did a fabulous show that's called The Seven Sisters, or it's Oil Parts 1, 2, and 3, the 3 2-hour segments, about how all this started, and it traces the history back the 20s and 30s, and how literally American interests became robber barons and proceeded to rape and pillage the Middle East until we had the political problems we have now. And you will hear them referred to frequently as the Seven Sisters, which is what the Arabs referred to them as, because they represent the Seven Sisters in the constellation up in the universe. And they built Iraq, they built Iran, they basically at one point didn't like a dictator in Iran in the 50s, and they overthrew him. And for a while, they actually had someone who was a CIA agent who had become the operating premier of Iran in the early 50s, because it just happened. It staged and they put a guy there, and basically he rose to the ranks until he had to accept the position, but he didn't last long. I mean, so how do you get around that fact?
There's a good book by that title, which I've actually read. I mean, as you well know, I think I told you last time, my father worked for Texaco for his entire career, so I'm very knowledgeable about the whole oil industry. And yeah, that book, Seven Sisters, was pretty much required reading, Aramco and all the rest of it. But I think one of the interesting things is Americans go on about all this stuff, and they don't realize that we actually get most of our so-called foreign oil comes from Canada.
Right.
It doesn't come from the Middle East. Europe depends on the Middle East. We don't. We don't depend on the Middle East anywhere near as much as Europe or Japan. And there are also other aspects. When it comes to, say, Anwar, where I think we should be drilling, where they put in pipelines, all the animals come and hang out because it grows grass, and it's also warm. But that's not to say, I think there's a lot of attitude that, like, you know, libertarians don't believe in alternative energy or any of those other things. And I think it's unfair to say so, because ultimately you can be against wind farms, which are a blot on the landscape, aren't very energy efficient, certainly not in somewhere like Maine, and basically been a way for some people to get rich off the government handouts. And you can say, like I am, I'm in favor of turbines, as in the tidal turbines, and they're sticking some out in the Bay of Maine, which is the second highest tide to the Bay of Fundy. It's underwater, no shipping is involved, no animals get hurt, it's out of the way. And another thing is they're always going, because when the tidal goes out, they still move. What people don't understand with wind turbines is the wind has to come from a certain direction at a certain speed, and if it's too slow or too fast, they don't work. And so I think the discussion about alternative energies, I think we should be energy efficient on all and sufficient on all things. However, just because you're against one form of alternative energy, which is a failure, like, I would argue, electric cars, doesn't mean that you're not in favor of something like turbine power and other forms of power that's not dependent on oil and or gas.
Okay, you bring up a great point. I was reading an article today on the subject of electric cars. And they were saying carbon footprint really isn't quite what's being portrayed, because where do you get the electricity from? And a lot of it comes from coal. So you're not actually, cutting your carbon footprint down by going electric. You're just creating more coal production. And part two of this, coal production is decreasing because guess what? We sell most of it to China. And China's economy is slowing down. Oops.
Well, yeah, that was inevitable because their economy is based upon ours, which is part of the genius of owing them money. If you've read anything of our founders, you know, we're talking about Aaron Burr and particularly the battle between he and Alexander Hamilton over whether the U.S. should be a debtor nation. That was always one of Burr's points, whether you agree with him or not, is that by becoming a debtor nation, people don't declare war on you. And I always thought it was a very interesting point, and he argued that for a long time, and where, you know, as you know, Hamilton was into no debt whatsoever and a variety of different approaches. And you disagree with that at all, Andy?
Andrew, don't call me Andy.
I'm sorry. I have several friends that prefer Andy, and I'm sorry it slipped out.
No, it's okay. It's all right. I think that argument, and I've read extensively on it, is fascinating. Whether to be a debtor nation, you know, or pretty much Alexander Hamilton is neither a borrower or a lender be, and I can see that. I can see that fundamental point. But Aaron Burr's point that if you know it's not in a country's best interest if you owe them money to attack you has some merit to it as well in the world of, especially now that we can get to each other so easily. But it does all go back to the debt and the deficit and spending, where we have this surreal situation, and I believe this is still the case, where we're actually sending money, American government is sending foreign aid to China for certain, because they've had these programs that have been there since China was a bit less developed, and they haven't stopped it. No one said, well, wait a second. When they're lending us money, why in the hell are we sending them foreign aid? And it's all a nonsense. And what really troubles me is neither the Republicans nor the Democrats, in the discussions I've seen, and whether it be in the Senate race or in the presidential race, none of them have any grasp on the situation, on the deficit. They talk a good game, the deficit and spending. There are no solutions. It's what the Republicans are proposing is evil and awful, or what the Democrats are proposing is evil and awful, but they're not offering practical solutions. And if you do offer a practical solution or a solution that might actually work, you're pilloried. You know, the Ryan's plan is supposed to be either this ultimately evil thing or this bit of genius, and it's a joke. Compare it to something like the Heritage Plan. It's just, you know, this is not even realistic, and it won't even do the job. And it also depends on all these factors and everything else.
Yeah.
I've come around to the, well, I sort of thought this for a while, but I figured out a way of catching it. I think one of the key things we need to do is to audit the Fed as soon as possible after the next election. I'm not really part of the end the Fed gang yet, because the end the Fed people don't have a viable solution to replace it. And you don't want that vacuum, because it could be replaced by something far worse. Just ask the American government about Libya. You know, you don't want to create a vacuum. That's never a good idea. But certainly auditing the Fed is absolutely key, and that should be done sort of, you know, as soon as possible after the...
Good luck. It's funny how it's being fought by a lot of people on both sides.
Well, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The problem with the Fed is it's being protected by both sides of the hill. I mean, the Fed, and by the way, for those who want an instructive viewpoint of the Fed, go back to the 1830s, because that was a constant issue and battle during the days of Andrew Jackson, who basically terminated the then existing Fed when his charter expired. I think it was 1832, if my memory is correct.
His name was Nicholas Biddle.
Nicholas Biddle, thank you
right.
very much.
You're welcome.
I was just struggling to remember his name. But at the end of the day, there were a great many problems, and after 10 years, they reconstructed the Fed. The problem with the Fed, like everything else, and the problem with his successor, is it becomes a source of manipulation. And whatever we create in that regard is going to be one long source of games and manipulation. And for that reason, and the fact that the lobbying in our country will not really allow it to go away, I think that has got to be one of the toughest things that anyone can possibly do in our society. If they can audit the Fed, I will be the happiest guy in the world. What do I think the odds are of auditing the Fed? Zero and none. And that's
not sad.
Pardon
me?
Well, certainly, if I mean, but the whole end of the Fed is kind of unrealistic as well. And audit is,
oh, yeah.
Audit would be a good start, as far as I'm concerned.
I think a lot of people would still be afraid of that audit, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Oh, very much so.
Well, you know, it could be done the way the BLA statistics are done on labor, too. You don't know. And, you know, but the bottom line is there will be so much resistance in, you know, the in D.C. that I just don't know how to get past. The average American knows so little about how our country runs in terms of the economics that getting support of the average American will be absolutely impossible, and those in Washington will gamble on it. And I'll give you an example. Right now we have a battle in California over labeling genetically you know, modified foods, something I support for my own personal reasons. I nearly died from them. But yet I'm looking at a barrage of industry advertisements that I think are among the worst and most deceitful that I've seen, oh, except other than our presidential elections. And actually they're worse. And the minute the moneyed interests, as people like to call them, step into this, then it's going to be very, very difficult for anyone to, the average citizen who doesn't understand this stuff, to sort through what's being said and come to a conclusion about what's good for a nation. Because they're simply not capable or interested enough to do that. And, Andrew, that's the biggest problem with it.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I'm trying not to bore the knickers off the nun. And trying to make it interesting, and you know, you really want to try to make yourself attractive in other ways besides just, you know, being the typical libertarian and banging on about the Fed and you know, the 10th Amendment. Although I obviously support the 10th Amendment and things like that. I mean, the ultimate funny thing was when there were people, libertarians amongst them, who were keen on starting a campaign to overturn the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. First of all, most people don't know what the hell it is, and it was going to be a way of saying, okay, yes, we want you to vote, so you to take away your vote. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
No one, no.
Okay, whoever is frying bacon in the
where's
background.
Where's that coming from? I don't know.
I hear it sound too.
I hear it too.
Well, it's certainly not me, so it has to be someone here, okay?
No, I'm upstairs. Sometimes on Blog Talk Radio, you get this problem all the time, where it sounds like people are, you know, dragging their phone.
You're on a mobile phone. Is that what it is? Cordless phone?
I'm on a cordless.
Uh-huh. I'm on a cordless. Maybe maybe they're spying on us.
We've been hit by the frying bacon police.
You know, I hope they are listening to us, because on a Sunday afternoon doing the show, I could use a little flattery. I really could. But, you know, please, guys, listen to us.
Well, you could be watching the Browns lose again, Manny.
Well, I knew that before the game started.
Well, in my case, I don't, you know, everybody tries to catch me out on stuff, and it's like, how are you going to catch me out when I've never changed what I said? And, you know, you can go back and read my book, Statism Sucks, and the way I've said it may be changed, but my message hasn't changed at all. And I think that makes it easier as a politician. I don't know how these politicians do it where they sort of change what they believe, as most people change their socks. How do you keep track of it all? I don't want to have to keep track of it. I want to say, you know, ultimately this is my position on this issue.
Let me ask everybody a question. That gets me right back to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is changing his story in midstream, and it doesn't seem like anybody cares. Where this was a big deal a few months ago about whether he was flip-flopping or not, he flip-flopped on a number of issues the other night, and nobody seemed to care. And that bothers me, not because I support one side or the other, because the truth is I like many things about Romney, but I don't like the fact that I'm considering voting for somebody who changes their position every day to a point where I don't even know what his position is anymore.
Well, Summers has done the same thing in our race.
Romney is an intelligent man, but he's hogtied by the party.
I think he was hogtied by the party during the primaries. I think if he would have come out, the guy who came out with that, how he came out on the debate, that's what he should have been saying and more consistent with what he was as governor and a businessman and all that when he was with Salt Lake, as opposed to this real, as you called him, Manny, a flip-flopper through the whole primary season.
Yeah.
And, you know, and now all of a sudden he comes out and he's not, you know, you're right. I mean, but then it goes back to what you both were saying earlier, all three of you, is why didn't the American people care? It's because Honey Boo Boo is more important. That's why.
Well, no, because, you know, or whatever, The Voice.
Reality TV show is more important than watching politics and learning about it. That's, you know, and they rely on that.
You know, well, of course. And, you know, that's why you get people occasionally saying, and, you know, I've been criticized, oh, you can't do something entertaining or funny or amusing or catchy. You know, politics is serious business. How are you can't make light of it, which is ridiculous. And I think that's, you're right. You can't make politics, they don't want you to make politics entertaining or amusing or catchy songs or the rest of it like they used to do in the 19th century or the early 20th century, because then more people will get involved. And what has amazed me is that the main Republican Party, and I'm sure it's happening in other places, is actively, and Charlie Summers is doing as well, they're actively and overtly disenfranchising people, and they don't give a damn. They don't care. They want to disenfranchise you. They actively want fewer people involved in how they're governed,
rather than more. I think that's an excellent observation. We saw that during this this primary, especially between when Santorum came from nowhere and against Romney, or you know, and then of course there was, and Ron Paul was kind of nipping at their heels lightly, but you saw straight arm by the establishment to get rid of those people out of the Republican Party, and it happened so well here in Mahoning County. We don't have a Republican Party, and that makes the Republicans who do run the party here very happy, because they get their little crumbs. And that's all they care about. They get the little seats on a couple boards, get a couple judges, they get this, and that's all they care about. And anybody who comes around trying to say, hey, look, we've got to talk about fiscal issues, tax policies or whatnot, you are straight on out of there or ignored. Vice versa with the Democratic Party, too.
That's very much the case in Maine.
Yeah, I mean,
they
same sort of thing.
They
just, if you're not going to be without, you know, I guess it all goes back to, you know, the political party that everyone warned against. You guys talked about Jefferson and Burr. I'm sorry, Hamilton and Burr. Excuse me, my dogs.
No, but actually Jefferson spoke about parties as well.
No, Manny, you might know, wasn't Hamilton in favor of political parties?
Yes, he was.
Right.
Hamilton was in favor. But the thing about political parties is, there are people who actively have told me, "Oh, third parties are always bad, and it's unfortunate that Maine actually encourages third parties." And I think that's wrong. I think we should have as many parties as possible. I see nothing wrong with having three, four, five major American political parties to reflect the various different ideas and wants and needs of Americans, because clearly the Republican Party and the Democratic Party don't. They, in fact, in some places, they're almost indistinguishable from each other. That's not the case
anywhere. I agree.
Well, that's a great point. But how do you fight? Here's what we all come down to, and what Manny has educated me on so well about. I mean, I was shocked when I saw how much money the Obama campaign brought in the month of September. And we know how much Romney's are bringing in and all these super PACs. How does anybody, you know, how does the Libertarian, the Greens, or all these other parties get to raise that sort of money in order to raise the profile, because that's what it takes? whether we all like it or not, that's what it takes.
But I actually think that game changer, and I honestly believe this, the game changer is the internet, because it allows you to reach out and get around the mainstream media, get around with social media and everything else. And in fact, in the state of Maine, the reason I'm being reported on as much as I am is because I've gone, right, you're not reporting on me, so I'll do social media and online and stuff like that. And the journalists just started going, well, there's a buzz going on online, and it reflects offline. And I think that is the major factor that's gonna break the two-party state.
Andrew, I believe that there was one of those sit-downs, but you weren't invited to it. Why not?
Well, there have been several, because, I mean, okay, as a libertarian, and Sam will agree with me on this, if a private organization or private, you know, whatever, grouping of organization, an organization doesn't want to invite you, that's their choice. You know, shit happens. They're not going to invite you. I mean, I think what really matters, because everything is so visual, is the fact that all the television networks, I'm part of all those debates, every single one of them. And as I said, I'm doing interviews on the three networks separately. But there are individual events where they just don't invite all six candidates. And you can say, you know, what you're holding is not legitimate, and you're denying your members access to all that's out there. But at the end of the day, they're a private organization, and they should be able to do what they want. However, it's probably wrong for the Maine Municipal Association, which is made up of municipalities, keeping only inviting the three major candidates. That's unethical, but it happens. But, you know, I can't complain.
Let's address that, because we have a lot of that going on in California. One of the primary causes is the candidates themselves who don't want to listen to you because you're going to ask the hard questions when they can structure the debate and field only easy questions. You're also like watching a sporting event where one side has everything to lose and the other side has nothing to lose. And there's nothing, as we all know, more scary in sports or anything in the world where the other side has absolutely nothing to lose. That's when they're most dangerous. So at the end of the day, you would be considered dangerous by your very presence. And having known you for a little bit of time here, I could agree more. I can see why they're afraid of you, because you're articulate, more articulate than they are, certainly more knowledgeable than most of these guys. So why would they want you at the table? So it's sort of like, why do a lot of people discriminate against minorities? Well, because they could compete with them for a job. And yep, that's the basis of all discrimination.
But I agree with you. But the ultimate thing that's very interesting, of course, is the fact that one of these guys, Summers, who's, you could argue that as a libertarian I'm closest to him rather than any of the other ones, there are debates which I'm involved with which he's dropping out of because he's just trying to run away from the debate, hence why I did the video. Manny, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but you'll have a good laugh.
I'm going to after the show, I promise.
You'll have a good laugh. And what we're mocking is the fact that he first of all, obviously doesn't want me in the debates, and because I'm there, he's not going to be involved. Because, you know, I directly threatened him. And, I mean, that shows a certain level of cowardice, which is just... The guy, by the way, has been in the military and goes on about his military record. And you sort of say to yourself, you know, you're saying you're going to be such a great leader and a senator and an inspiring leader and everything else, yet you're running away from debates on issues like women's issues, foreign policy, what's the other one he's skipping, health issues, all this stuff. And it's like absolutely, abjectly ridiculous.
Okay, but maybe one of the reasons is that the news organizations, don't want to split the vote. And
well,
libertarian and Republicans, you know, tend to split the vote, and the Democrat romps in
I mean, but then again, we have six, man. We got six here, three of whom, the other three, are all left of center. So, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? And to be fair, and I want to compliment Channel 6, Channel 8, Channel 13, and Fox News in Maine, all of them are having, and Maine Public Broadcasting, they're having us all in.
Uh-huh.
All of us are invited. If we're on
the ballot.
Great,
you know, that's a victory in itself.
Yeah. I mean, my libertarian friends across the country are going, what? You know, yeah, it's brilliant.
You know, one of the things about the third, you know, I worked on John Anderson's campaign in 1980 for my college.
Oh, yeah,
admit that? Shame on you. I can't believe that.
I don't like you anymore. I did.
But it was, and I helped get signatures to put him on the ballot in Ohio. This is 1980 through college. It was so easy because every college campus wanted him on. So it was easy to go recruit other people at colleges, run around, get all the kids to sign, get the signatures, get him on the ballot, piece of cake. That was 1980. Now, let me see what that 20. 32 years later, right? It's so hard to get third-party libertarian green candidates on the ballots. And it's like these guys, the powers that be on both sides, the Democrat and Republican parties, saw the success of John Anderson. Then, of course, the huge success of Ross Perot. Mm-hmm. And they've gone way out of their ways to make sure other people don't have access, to the point that they don't let Gary Johnson speak. I mean, heck, he was kicked out of the Republican debates. And he had one great line.
I tell you what, man. First of all, I hate you because I lost my first girlfriend because she supported Anderson and I supported Reagan. So it's your fault. It's your damn fault. And secondly, I think that very much depends on the state. There are some states, and I say it, they tend to be New England states, possibly because they're close to England, and England has lots of parties on the ballot. You know, if you can get your ass in gear and get on, they'll let you on. You have to pay a fee and everything else. And as the farther you get south and Midwest and towards the West, that's when, you know, they try to keep libertarians off the ballot. But in New England, they seem to be pretty cool about the whole deal. We're very fortunate. And so and that's the irony, and that's why we made the video. The irony is Maynards are being offered this choice of six relatively diverse, different ways of looking at our problems facing this country and facing the state. And the TV networks are actually giving them that choice and showing them that choice. And so are all these organizations that are inviting us all. But the candidates are going, oh, man, I don't want to debate him. Holy crap. And they're running away because they've never been challenged in that sort of way. And it's absolutely fascinating. And hopefully this will spread. Hopefully, you know, my candidacy and the candidacy of a couple of the other people will inspire all of this, that other states will say, we've been getting pretty crap candidates. I mean, oh, my God, Aiken, hello. Can you imagine if you're a Republican in that state with that dimwit as the nominee? And the rest of them, O'Donnell and the rest of them, because there's no choice, there's no choice, and the populace is getting fed up, and I think there's a strong movement, partly, as I said, by the Internet, and there's access into information. People are finding out about parties like the Constitution Party and the Libertarian Party and the Justice Party. There's another one called the Justice Party, and even Americans Elect, which is another party. And I think ultimately, we're going to see, I don't know how quick it's going to be, but I think ultimately we are going to see a strong third, fourth, and possibly fifth party, possibly in my lifetime, but certainly in the next 50 years, I think, because of the Republicans and Democrat Party, unless, of course, by the way, one of those parties ceases to be, and I think if either of them ceases to be, it will probably be the Republican Party.
Well, let me offer you a couple of thoughts. One, I generally agree with you. The Republican Party going through a cycle that I call the poor leadership cycle. The Democrats went through it during the Dukakis Mondale period, where they had no real viable leader. No one really seized control of the party. The party looked like it was just falling apart at the seams. They made the same kind of stupid decisions that McCain did when they decided to run. Geraldine Ferraro had a snowball's chance in hell of affecting the election. And so they were all sort of grasping for straws, trying to look for a way to be competitive in a market in which they weren't competitive. And therein lies what the problem is. We've had other periods in our time. Certainly the Civil War is an example, because the Republican Party didn't really exist before the Civil War very much, and where events changed the base. And then we have a period in my life that you guys probably aren't old enough to experience, but John F. Kennedy's position on civil rights caused basically the entire South to swing to the Republican Party. And even though they may have remained Democrats, some of them registered, their basic affiliation was going to be with the Republican Party, because they were the party opposing all of the basic racial integration. So events do change in some ways that people don't always notice, and that's a classic example of one.
Yeah, because for the most part, and it's confusing, and I've been trying to talk to some of my friends in other parts of the world that are interested in politics.
Okay, I have to jump in real quick.
We're about to lose
our live listeners, but fear not, it's all being recorded for posterity.
Okay.
And we will have our dead listeners. They will be listening to the next section.
Right.
Yes, our dead listeners from Chicago.
But, yes, and we will let them vote.
We will let them vote. But ultimately what happened was, the Democrat and Republican Party, it's always fascinating. I mean, obviously, in the early 20th century, the Democrat Party and the late 19th century, the Democrat Party was very much the party of you know, that spawned the KKK and all the first black politicians were all Republican. And then somewhere in the 60s, it switched the other way. But, I mean, I think I could see the Republican Party going the way of the Whigs, because it's not reflecting the values of anybody on the right. And, in fact, it's imploding. It is imploding in Maine. I mean, it's imploding. And a lot of other states is imploding. And the establishment is trying to force it to exist. And the more they try to force it to stay where the way they want it, the more chance it's going to implode.
I agree.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. And some of this also reflects the changes in our population base. The greater the poverty, the more the switch. And in that regard, we're comparing a period that relates a little bit to the Great Depression, because a lot of what's going on are the knee-jerk responses of people you saw during the Great Depression, who switched positions rather quickly. And the Great Depression was horrible for the Republican Party. It took Eisenhower, who wasn't even really a Republican, to salvage that for them.
Excellent history lesson, Manny. But yeah, I can see if the Republican Party loses this election and gets trounced or whatever in the Senate, doesn't take, and maybe loses the House, I could see them splitting in two. I could see the fiscal, I guess the Tea Party members, the Mintz, the Marco Rubios, the Rand Pauls, and leaving the splitting and starting a party that's more in line with the economic issues and aid and that, and getting away from the social issues. Because the social, here in my part, neck of the woods, the Republican establishment is more into talking about abortion than it is talking about the debt. And it's ridiculous.
Then you have that surreal argument, and I had this bizarre discussion with someone in the Tea Party movement in 2009, where they said, I'm for limited government, except I want the federal government to ban abortion, I want the federal government to ban gay marriage, and I want the federal government to do a third thing. And so I said, so you believe in limited government, but you want the federal government to nationalize a woman's womb. And they said, yes, if it's not for procreation, she shouldn't be having sex in the first place. And yes, the federal government should ban all abortion for any reason. And I'm just going, and you say you're for limited government.
That summed them up. That's the drum beating issue. And it just, and that sound just drives me away from them, and many others too. And that's what that Santorum ring of the party wants. And, you know, every Sunday they're going to church, they're giving whatever the church is, they're giving all this money. They got ministers preaching to them about how to vote, what to spend their money on, and what to do, but not to solve any of the problems. Uh-huh. Talk about that abortion issue. Talk about gay marriage. And you're absolutely right, Andrew, about that. Is that, and that person you spoke to really is the epitome of what's wrong with the Republican Party today.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, as you know, Sam, a point I raise constantly is I don't care what you guys tell me. Sooner or later, you got to deal with the fact that a large part of the Republican Party is so narrowly focused on those individual issues that they completely miss the point about where our nation is and what our problems are. And it's scary.
You're right. And then when they do get a candidate, and when they do get a candidate or some people, and they have some in the Senate and they have some in the House, maybe, you know, that's it, those people are, you know, they're silenced. When they speak, I bet you when Rand Paul speaks, probably, if they pull back the camera, he's probably the only one in the chamber.
You know,
you see that all the time. It's too bad. You know, you know what, Manny? We've got to get 435 Mr. Smiths in Washington in the House, right?
Absolutely.
And
now
senators.
you can see why we think it's so important to remake the movie. And Andrew, to understand this conversation, I represent Frank Capra's family, who are very close friends of mine, and that's one of our projects on the table we're discussing with the studios right now, is remaking Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, although we have two other projects that are equally exciting, and one of them is a Mr. Smith-type story about personal rights and rights that you advocate commonly when we talk to you. So anyway, go ahead. So, yeah, and Sam, I think this is important. I think that, and I also think there's an issue that everyone's missing. I always compare the Internet to the Gutenberg Bible, and I compare it because the Gutenberg Bible allowed people across the world to communicate through the use of pamphlets and a wide variety of other things, and it made it virtually impossible for, you know, countries to cut off communications because, as we all know, the Catholic Church ruled this world for a long time by controlling the dissemination of information. So now it can't be controlled anymore, and since it can't be controlled anymore, goodness knows where it's going to take us, but I do know wherever it takes us going to be a better place than where we are now. Mm-hmm. And I think that, and in that respect, I absolutely, completely agree with you.
I mean, my candidacy wouldn't exist if it weren't for the Internet, without a doubt.
Can I bring up, I hate to be cynical, and I do agree with both you gentlemen about the Internet. Won't the bad guys realize that that's a threat to them and start trying to pass laws and do all that sort of stuff to limit our ability to do great things with the Internet? Because I do agree with what you're saying.
I think that's difficult to do.
Well, first of all, Google and the rest of them tried it, and they were slapped down by the FCC recently. What they want to do is they've taken a position that all of the content that appears on their show, basically their internet, is basically owned by them. Therefore, they have a right to control the content. Therefore, they can eliminate people and decide whose views are going to show during that period of time. That is a clear effort to control the content of the internet. So this debate is going on every day, and everybody, Fox is at the forefront of this, and they've taken some strong steps to try to perfect their rights and deter other people from doing something similar. In fact, for those of us who don't care for Fox, to make sure that this agenda got followed, Murdoch sent his worthless son, who's the head of most of the problems of what's going on in England, to the United States to take over Fox News in the United States.
I noticed that, yeah.
Did that make you laugh? I almost fell over laughing.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty funny. I only watch Special Report on Fox. Most of their shows, primetime shows, drive me up a bloody wall. Fox Business isn't bad. I think it's a better network, and Fox Business has Stossel on it. So, I mean,
that isn't the issue, Andrew. The issue is, and I always jokingly sum it up like this in movie news. You've seen the Bond film tomorrow, Never Dies. Well, do you realize that is a parody of Murdoch?
Oh, I'm sure.
And that whole plot was written because of Murdoch, and that's what prompted that action. So at the end of the day, you know, when someone warrants to being parodied as a villain in a James Bond film, one has to stop and go, gee, isn't that a wonderful guy? You know?
Okay, gentlemen, I do have to throw a flag on the play.
I wish we could meet at a local bar, guys.
Oh, well, a fantasy
yes,
of mine.
Who do I?
A fantasy.
We'd close that puppy somewhere around Wednesday.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well,
I'll bring the keys.
Check out the video. It was great to be on here, man. I really enjoy it. I'm glad we're ending it because my phone is about to die. You know, I'm happy to come back post-election, get in touch with me, and thank you for support. And if I could ask any of your listeners, if they haven't been tapped out by every other election campaign, go to dodgeforsenate.com and give me some money, and I'll keep pushing these issues.
Uh-huh. Great.
The next time we talk to you, we're going to have to be calling you Senator Dodge.
Well, this has been a strange campaign, man, and anything could happen. I mean, you know, that would be, when I'm senator, it will be mind-blowing and hilarious.
And I'll volunteer Manny Balling to be your legal counsel.
I am in this race to win. And I tell you what, anything's possible in this race. It's nuts. It's nuts.
Go for
it. It's chaos. And I have no idea what's going to happen on November 6th in the main center race. I have absolutely no idea.
Andrew, just know you're always welcome on the show. I will read it. I'll drop you a note and let you know how I felt about it. You know, it's just a pleasure. You know, it's hard to find people that can cover as many topics as skillfully as you, and we look forward to doing it again. And we'll keep an eye on you. You know, we're there. We'll always be there.
All right. Talk to you later, guys. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure. Have a good week, guys. Bye-bye.
Wrap it
up.
And you, Sam, I'm sure you have some Oscar the Grouch comment.
Well, my first thing I'm going to do is, as soon as I get off the phone, I'm going to go on his website and make a donation to him. That's number one. That was a pleasure to talk to somebody who's, running a United States Senate campaign in a state and has a chance. That's going to be on television. I mean, that's fabulous, and he's a libertarian. Great for the state of Maine, and good for him, and we need more people like that. I hope it happens, and anything is possible in today's world, no question about it. I want to thank you guys for having me on again. I love this Sunday. Manny, this is my local bar. Via the phone. The only thing I don't do is drink when I'm talking with you guys. But I really appreciate it. I appreciate the emails, the banter back and forth with both you gentlemen and Peter and John when that happens. And, you know, I'm working at a better pace now because of getting to know you gentlemen, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the compliment.
Right. Manny, your parting shot.
Well, my parting shot is very simple. We need more people like Andrew Ian Dodge. We need more people with various views talking to Americans to try to wake them up to the reality of what's going on. And hopefully we'll be able to do it, and we're going to have Andrew back after the election's over to give us his perspective on the winners and losers, and I hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. And, of course, this is going to be a beautiful autumn week, so get out and enjoy all those beautiful red leaves, right?
Right.
As long as you don't have to rake them.
No. I don't do garden stuff.
I know you're British. Sign us
okay.
off, Simon.
I just want to wish everyone a happy, healthy, and safe day. And we will be back next weekend. Who knows who will be joining us on air? I certainly don't. Till
it's not like Halloween already.
Yeah.
Well, it is Halloween.
We're
going to get John a Snickers bar.
In honor of Edward R. Murrow, we're going to end it with good night and good luck.
Okay. Good night and good luck.
Perfect.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Later, Gators. Bye.